But once again, I'd like to thank you all for being here. We have one more of these left. I've enjoyed them immensely. I look forward to them every month. Next month is about the 50s. We're going to talk about the Cold War, and we're going to talk about the space race, and we're going to talk about the Mickey Mouse Club. Bring your hula hoops and your poodle skirts if you want to, and your mouse ears, and we'll talk about the Civil Rights Movement and everything that went on in the 50s. So it's going to be lots and lots of fun. A famous American was born in 1952 on March 10th. Me. I will say one more thing. A lot of you have asked about next year. I don't know anything about next year. I'm just one day at a time. But last week I signed a contract with a television production company in New York City to create a television show about me. I don't know which direction it's going to go, but they're calling it Huck's History or something like that. And we're going to travel over the nation, and they're going to film me talking about history at the historical sites. And then we're going to try to sell it to the History Channel. It's the same company that does Pawn Stars. If you've watched that, not porn stars, Pawn Stars. So you may get to just sit home and learn at home on TV next year. A couple of years ago, I was at the Publix store, and we're getting ready to watch a football game. I was in such a hurry. I had to run to the store to get some hot dogs and buns and things I needed to round out my tailgate. And I just had an armload of stuff. And I saw that one aisle that didn't have a big old line in it. And there was an old man going toward that aisle. And I was just torn because I knew I could hurry up and beat him. But then I thought that would be rude. So I did the right thing for once and just stood there and let him get in line. It took him forever to unload the things he had in his buggy. He would just bend over and pick it up and look at it and put it on the shelf. And I was sitting there looking at my watch, looking at my cell phone, wondering when the kickoff was. I was so put out because I had such important things to do. And then the lady told him how much he owed, and he reached in his pocket, and it took him forever to pull out this little purse. My grandmama used to have one of those purses. It was a little leather purse with the snaps on top, y'all remember? And he couldn't hardly do it like that to open it. And then he pulled out a handkerchief, and he had his money tied up in a handkerchief. And I was twiddling my thumbs, I was everything, and he got his handkerchief untied and all of his money fell on the ground. So I leaned over and was helping him pick up his coins, and he reached down to pick up a coin, and I saw a big ring on his hand, and it had USMC on it. I said, "Sir, were you in the Marine Corps?" "Well, yes, I was." I said, "What years did you serve?" He said, "I entered the Marine Corps on December the 9th, 1941. And I served until October 1945. I said, "Did you see a lot of action?" "Oh, not that much. I was at Guadalcanal and Tarawa and Saipan and the Philippines and Iwo Jima and Okinawa. And you know, I felt about this tall because I was standing behind an American hero." Ironically, we're teaching about World War II in my class right now. And yesterday, I made mention of the greatest generation, and I asked my class as a whole, how many of you know what the greatest generation is and what that means? And one young man raised his hand and said, "It refers to the generation who lived through the Depression and supposedly saved the world during World War II. And I asked that young man, what do you mean by supposedly? And he said, well, I think the world would still be here. It didn't really matter what they had done. And it had been a long time since I'd had a come to Jesus meeting in public school. But we had one for about the next hour yesterday. And today we're going to talk about World War II. There is no way that I could presume to cover any, even a small percentage of what we need to talk about in the time allotted for World War II. And I'm not going to even try. I'm just going to talk about some things that I think are important that we be reminded of. I don't have any idea how these lights work. I don't know if they can dim without going off or anything, but Mike Yoder does. And if they could be a little bit not so bright, I think we could see the videos a little better. Thank you, Mike. Well, these three guys are really kind of responsible for World War II. These are some bad characters right here. You know, nowadays they tell us there are no good and there is no bad. It's just all different perspectives. That's not true. There is evil in the world. And these guys were evil. And I'm sure you recognize all of these people. Adolf Hitler, Benito Mussolini, and Emperor Hirohito, who was probably a pawn in the hand of Tojo, the military commander, but we'll save that discussion for another day. Interestingly enough, Adolf Hitler was chosen by his people. Adolf Hitler didn't take over by force as a dictator. Adolf Hitler was elected to rule because of promises he made the electorate. And the same year that Franklin D. Roosevelt was elected to rule or lead or serve in the United States. Mussolini, El Duque, the leader, had come to power in Italy long before Hitler and created a fascist state. And I guess Hirohito inherited his power. But these people all were strong nationalists, and they all wanted more and more resources to build their nation. And of course, they came to power during a great worldwide depression when resources were at a minimum. World War II, as I'm sure you all remember from high school, had its seeds planted in the Treaty of Versailles, which ended World War I. The end of World War I, Woodrow Wilson, the guy in the tall hat there, he's in between David Lloyd George, the English representative to the Treaty of Versailles, and Clemenceau, the French, arrived in France very naive with a 14-point peace plan. The 14th point of his plan was a League of Nations that would solve the world's problems by diplomacy and put an end to war. But Germany, France, and England, and Russia had been fighting long before the United States entered the war. We lost 116,000 men in World War I, every one a precious soul, but those countries had lost millions of men. And France and England wanted retribution. They wanted to punish Germany for their role in World War I, so they wouldn't hear of any of Woodrow Wilson's lenient plans for peace. They did adopt his 14th point, the League of Nations, but the United States Senate refused to ratify the treaty, so we never joined the League of Nations, so it never really had any power whatsoever. And the Treaty of Versailles put harsh reparations on Germany. They took land away from Germany, and Germany had to pay billions and billions and billions of dollars in reparation, which they did for a few years with money they borrowed from the United States. But eventually, when the Depression came, Germany quit paying back their money, and all the Treaty of Versailles had done was to make the German people bitter and make them ripe for a leader like Hitler, who promised to restore Germany to its greatest power. In the 30s, these nations began to expand. Mussolini invaded Ethiopia. In Spain, they were fighting a civil war in which a fascist leader would take over Spain, supported by Mussolini and Hitler. And in Japan, Hirohito and the Japanese military was taking over Manchuria and other parts of China, getting ready to spread their influence and their power all over the Pacific realm. But the worst, of course, was Hitler. Hitler claimed that the German people needed Lebensraum, which means living space, room to spread out. What he really wanted was resources. When Hitler came to power, by that point, Germany had already completely disregarded any of the entities of the Treaty of Versailles. Hitler was already building up a secret military power, mostly in the Soviet Union. They were building tanks and airplanes and ships in the Soviet Union with the knowledge of Stalin. And he was preparing his military. He was also indoctrinating the school children. Every day, the school children had to stand up and say a little poem in which they acknowledged the fact that Hitler was their god, that the party was all powerful. So he was indoctrinating the minds of the people, and he was promising them great riches that he would accomplish through war. First thing that Hitler did was occupy the Rhineland, which is a section of what had once been Germany along the Rhine River. As I said, Hitler said he needed that for living space. He really needed that for food, because the Rhine River was a very, very, very fertile farmland. And he wanted to occupy that land so that he could begin to raise food to feed his troops during time of war. Now, the signees of the Treaty of Versailles, primarily France and England, were responsible for enforcing the treaty. But France and England were having their own problems. France and England had lost millions of soldiers in World War I. They didn't want to fight Hitler. They weren't willing to fight Hitler, so they just pretended that it wasn't happening. Those who refuse to learn from history are doomed to repeat its mistakes. They pretended it wasn't happening. Then Hitler declared an Anschluss and took over Austria. We've all seen that in The Sound of Music, exactly what happened. And of course, France and England pretended it wasn't happening. And then Hitler took over part of Czechoslovakia called the Sudetenland, which is all this red area right here. He claimed he needed it for living space for the German people. What he really needed was the minerals that were there. It was rich in iron ore. It was rich in oil. It was rich in coal. So he needed these things to build and fuel his war machine. And once he took over the Sudetenland and was openly showing off his Hitler youth and his giant and still growing military, the leaders of Europe and the free world decided that they needed to confront Adolf Hitler. So they asked for a meeting, and he invited them to Munich. Neville Chamberlain, the Prime Minister of England, Great Britain, met with Hitler and representatives from the other European, Western European nations in Munich. And Hitler convinced them, if you'll just let me have the land that I've already gotten, I've got everything I need now. This used to be Germany. These were German-speaking people. I've got it now. Then I won't bother anybody else. I don't need anything else. I'm done. So, very, very, very eager to avoid war at all costs or any cost, the signees of the Treaty of Versailles agreed, and Neville Chamberlain returned home to England and announced to the whole world, "We have achieved peace for our time." Appeasement did not work prior to World War II, and appeasement will not work now. You can't appease a thug. So as soon as Chamberlain got home, Hitler invaded Czechoslovakia and took the whole country. And now Poland was surrounded on three sides. Poland turned to England and France and said, "Look what you've done. Hitler is gathering his troops on our border, and now he's going to attack us." And so France and England signed into an agreement with Poland that if Hitler attacked Poland, they would come to his rescue. In the meantime, Hitler had, of course, signed a non-aggression pact with the Soviet Union so that he wouldn't have to worry about fighting a war on two fronts. While all this was going on, while all the thugs in the world were trying to take over more and more and more land in an effort, realistically, to try to take over the whole world, the United States, for the most part, was determined to remain neutral. We had moved after World War I from a position of intervention to a position of isolationism. We said, you know, World War I wasn't our war. We lost all of these men. It was so expensive. We're not going to do that again. United States believed that we were protected by our great oceans, the Atlantic Ocean on the east and the Pacific Ocean on the west. And most people in the United States felt that we did not need to be in this war. So as you can see, the sentiment in the United States is that we're going to stay out of it. We're going to stay out of it. We're going to stay out of it. Not everybody in the United States believed that, but the majority did. And Congress tends to do what the majority wants, because if they don't, then they'll get voted out of office. So as Hitler expanded his power and his position of strength, and as the Japanese expanded their position of strength, we tried to remain out of the war. We were determined to do that. During this time period, it's my opinion that this man saved the world almost single-handedly. I look for a picture that's like a map in my schoolroom. I have a map of my schoolroom that everything Hitler controlled in North Africa and Europe in 1940. And it's all yellow, which represents neutral countries, orange, which represents countries he already owned, and some other color that represents countries he took over. Purple is the color that represents what he didn't control. And the only piece of purple on that map in Europe is the island of England and a little bitty corner of North Africa in Egypt, which was a British colony. And most of the British were ready to give up too. Chamberlain was replaced by Sir Winston Churchill. And through force of will, Winston Churchill almost single-handedly kept the British spirit up so that they wouldn't give up the fight. Hitler launched the Blitz, and the Battle of Britain began. Hitler believed that he could take over England with just his Luftwaffe, with just his air force. He was convinced he could bomb England into submission. He didn't want to have to invade, because if you invade, there's always extremely high casualties, and he thought, I'll just drop enough bombs on them till they give up. We tried the same thing in 1991 in Iraq, but we had to put soldiers on the ground in Iraq to go in and clean up the mess. So Hitler launched the Battle of Britain, and the Royal Air Force fighters would rise up and go up to take on the German planes, and it lasted month after month after month. Winston Churchill would walk among the rubble of London. Sometimes he would go out while the bombs were still falling to try to show the British people that he wasn't afraid. There's a slogan that has emerged over the last year or so. I see it on the internet referring to everything. But this originated with Winston Churchill during the Battle of Britain. Posters everywhere in London, keep calm and carry on. Keep calm and carry on. I'm sure you've seen those messages too. Churchill made speeches on the radio. Last time we talked about FDR's fireside chats. Winston Churchill would address the British people almost every day. He would speak before Parliament frequently, encouraging them. One of his most famous speeches, "We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our little island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. We will never give up. We will never give up. We will never give up. We will never give up." Over and over and over, Churchill made similar speeches. And sometimes he would end with, "And if our little island lasts 1,000 years, nay 10,000 years, history will look back on us and say, this was their finest hour." He said of the Royal Air Force, "Never in the course of human history have so many done so much, have so few done so much for so many." Winston Churchill kept England from giving up. And Winston Churchill, from the day he became Prime Minister, was looking across the ocean at FDR, pleading with him to come to the aid of England. And FDR liked Roosevelt, Churchill, and he knew that he needed to help, but Congress still wasn't willing. When all of this started, we passed a series of, I thought I had those, neutrality acts. I lost a slide. Congress passed a series of neutrality acts in the 1930s that was intended to keep us out of the war. They said, "We will not sell arms to any belligerent. We have been drawn into World War I because we were selling weapons to England and France. We were trading with England and France. Germany started blowing up our submarines with U-boats. I mean, our merchant ships with U-boats. So we're not going to let that happen. We're not going to sell arms, and whatever we do sell, cash and carry." We got into a huge amount of debt at the end of World War I, and nobody paid us back, except Mrs. Kelly, what nation? Finland. Finland is the only nation in the world that paid us back the money we had loaned during World War I. So we said, we're not going to get into that again. We're not going to be everybody's pocketbook. We're not going to loan them the money. And we're not going to sell you ammunition or arms. And if you do buy something from us, it's cash and carry. You're going to pay us cash, and you're going to have to transport it yourself. And so that's what Roosevelt had to deal with. So at first, he started trying to figure out ways to get around Congress. And he was pretty good at that. He said, "Well, Congress will not let me sell you anything, but we do have some stuff we can trade you. We've got a lot of old destroyers from World War I. We've got a lot of planes. We've got a lot of tanks. We will trade those to you. And Churchill said, well, what do I have that you need? I don't have any money. He said, we'll trade you those for the rights to build air bases in England. So Churchill said, fine. So Churchill gave us land to build air bases in England, and we gave him our old military equipment. Roosevelt also realized that we were headed to the war no matter what. So Roosevelt got Congress to pass a peacetime draft and to originate $1 billion so that we could go ahead and start building up our military before we needed it, which was a rarity for the United States. He also signed into effect the Lend-Lease Act. He said, we will not sell England armaments. They don't have any money, but we will loan them tanks and planes and ships and bullets and hand grenades and cannons and any weapons we have, as long as they'll promise to give it back after the war. That's like me asking Pat Price to loan me her chewing gum and promising I'll give it back when I've got all the sugar out of it. And so Congress realized that we had to be on the side of the Allies in the war, and Roosevelt signed the Lend-Lease Act, which brought us in closer to the war, because once again, we were the arsenal for democracy. Japanese had been expanding and expanding and expanding. First, they had taken over Manchuria. Then they moved north and took over Shanghai. They moved west and took over Peking, which is now Beijing. They were expanding their influence all over Asia, into China, into Korea. And Roosevelt attempted to stop this aggression with a quarantine act. We had been selling scrap metal to the Japanese, and they'd been using it to build bombs with. We quit selling anything to the Japanese, and we froze all of their assets in American banks. So tension was building. Tension was building. Tension was building. The world was at war. We were still trying to stay out of it. Most people realized we wouldn't be able to, but we liked to pretend that we would. So we just ignored what was going on, like an ostrich with their head in the sand. December 6th in Hawaii was just a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful day. It was a Saturday. I don't know who's been to Hawaii, who's been to Honolulu or Waikiki. It's a wonderful place. It's the most beautiful place I've ever been. There were thousands and thousands and thousands of young military men in Hawaii. Pearl Harbor was the naval base. Schofield Barracks was an army base. Hickam Field was an air base. Thousands of American young men. And Saturday night, 3 weeks before Christmas, they were all over Waikiki, going up and down Ala Moana Boulevard, into the bars and the restaurants and the clubs. There was a big band competition on December 6th in 1941. All of the ship's bands competed in the Waikiki Shell, and the USS Arizona band finished second, which was the highest they had ever finished. And so their captain said, the whole ship can sleep in tomorrow. Unless you have early duty or in the mess hall or whatever, you can just sleep in. Sunday morning, December 7th, it was a little bit lax, a little bit slack in Pearl Harbor. Some guys had gotten up early to go to church. There were certain people that had morning duty. They were up at work. There were a lot of sailors who were still recovering from a night on the town on Ala Moana Boulevard. Everybody almost in the USS Arizona was still in their racks asleep. And at 8:05 in the morning on a Sunday morning, the Japanese task force flew over Diamond Head on the eastern side of Oahu and split into three groups. One group attacked Hickam Field, one group attacked Schofield Barracks, and the main group attacked Pearl Harbor. throwing America into World War II, whether we wanted to be or not. Almost 3,000 people lost their lives that day. The Japanese also launched surprise attacks on the Philippines. The USS Arizona was hit with a direct hit. You've probably heard the ship just rose up, broke in half, and sank to the bottom. Over 1,000 men died on the Arizona alone. They couldn't raise the ship. They didn't have time to raise the ship. They left those men there, and the Arizona became their tomb. Some of them lived for a couple of weeks because when divers would go down, they could hear them tapping on the inside of the ship. But there was nothing they could do because they couldn't use torches to go after them because there was so much gasoline and fuel in the water that it would have caused an explosion. We'd lost even more people. One thing was lucky that day. We had our entire Navy, our Pacific Fleet, moored in Pearl Harbor, lined up side by side, row by row, our entire fleet, because we thought it was impenetrable. It's a deep, big, large harbor with a narrow opening. We had submarine nets on the opening. We had guns and lookouts. We thought that we were completely safe. Benjamin Franklin wrote in Poor Richard's Almanac, "Don't put all your eggs in one basket." We had all of our eggs in one basket, and the Japanese attacked it. But the one thing that was lucky that day was that our entire fleet of aircraft carriers was off on a training mission. So we didn't lose any aircraft carriers on December 7th. 80% of the rest of the fleet was destroyed or damaged and down at the bottom of Pearl Harbor. A lot of people think Pearl Harbor was called Pearl Harbor because it must have pearls in it. No, the water, if you go in the middle of the day, is tidy bowl blue. It's the most beautiful water I've ever seen. But in the mornings and the evenings at dusk and dawn, it turns a milky white when the sun hits it at a certain angle. So the natives called it their word for pearls because it looked like pearl, the top of the water. Well, when the Japanese made two strikes, they had planned a third, but the task force was called back after the second round because they had lost surprise. And then when they returned to their aircraft carrier, the Japanese admiral was already having buyer's remorse. And he remarked, "I'm afraid that all we have done is awaken a sleeping giant." And that's exactly what they had done. The next day, December 8th, President Roosevelt convened Congress and asked for a declaration of war. President of the United States cannot declare war. He's the commander-in-chief, but only Congress can declare war. In the Senate, the vote was unanimous. In the House of Representatives, there was one person, a female congressman from the state of Washington who was born in Georgia, who was a Quaker and a pure pacifist, voted against the resolution. War had been declared on Japan. Germany, who had signed a non-aggression pact with Japan, declared war on the United States. We declared war on Germany, and we're involved in the war. We're involved in the war. We are in the war. You know, we're in a war now. December 7th, 1941, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. We were without a Navy. By May in 1941, we had rebuilt a Navy and defeated the Japanese at the Battle of Midway, which was the turning point of the Pacific War. From December is January, February, March, April, May. 5 months, y'all. Jimmy Doolittle had figured out a way to strip down bombers, take them off of aircraft carriers, and drop bombs on Tokyo just to let them know that we were still around. 6 months. 6 months. In 4 years, we had defeated Hitler. In 4 years, we had defeated Tojo. The war was over. World Trade Center was bombed on September 11th, or attacked on September 11th, 2001. This picture was made 2 days ago. It's a soldier being brought home from Afghanistan. That's 12 years. What's the difference? And what's the difference? The difference is the word I've said about a dozen times in the last 30 seconds, we. We were involved in World War II. Now, I know that some of you have sent sons and brothers and husbands to Afghanistan and Iraq. Some of you may have served yourself. But most of us, if you really be honest with yourself, we're not at war. Those kids over there in Afghanistan, they're at war. Other than the fact that it's a pain in the butt to go through airport security, I'm not involved in the war. I haven't done anything in the war effort. That's the difference between our current nation and our nation that answered the call after World War II, that greatest generation. We were a generation then in which we said, Uncle Sam's fixing to roll up his sleeves, and we're going to do whatever has to be done, whatever it takes, whatever is necessary. Now we are a generation which says, what are you going to do for me? What's the government going to do for me? What's the country going to do for me? That is the change. The day after Pearl Harbor, men were lined up around the block in cities at the enlistment offices, waiting to enlist to serve their country. My daddy told me a story. You know, some of you are that generation. Do we have any World War II veterans here today? Would you stand up and be recognized, sir? Thank you. Thank you so very much for your service. My father and mother remembered, always used to tell stories. Everybody in their generation would remember exactly where they were, what they were doing, who they were with when they heard the news about the Japanese attacking Pearl Harbor. And they would swap the stories over and over and over and over and over. I can tell you where them and every one of their friends were when they heard about Pearl Harbor. And I wasn't even born. And I never understood that until 9/11. And now, of course, I know exactly where I was and exactly what I was doing. And I bore my students and my children with that same story. So they'll be able to tell me. But we were at war in 1941. And we were ready to fight. We fought in the Pacific. We had to take back those islands. We had to use the Navy, the Army Air Corps, the Marines, and the Army to take back those islands. It was not pleasant work. It took 4 years. We had to take those islands one by one by one by one by one. Because we were convinced that in order to win the war, we were going to have to stage an invasion of Japan. And if we were going to have to stage invasion of Japan, we had to have a territory to build a base. And so we had to get rid of all those islands that the Japanese had captured. We had to use the Navy to bomb the islands and try to soften it up. We had to use the Marines to go ashore. We had to use the Air Corps to go over and soften up and drop bombs. And we had to use the soldiers to take the island. The Japanese casualties were always going to be about 100%. The Japanese believed that they were fighting for the emperor, which was the same as fighting for God, and they believed that the greatest honor that they could have was to die for the emperor. So we couldn't just get them to submit. We had to keep fighting until every single Japanese had been killed or captured. And that's what we were asking our young men, 17, 18, 19, 20, up into their 30s, to do. To take those islands away from the Japanese. And it took weeks and weeks and weeks in every instant. Tremendously high death rates for Americans. But we did it. We fought the Japanese in the Pacific. We fought the Germans in North Africa. Rommel and the tanks and the panzers. We fought in Italy. And we fought in Europe. We fought in Normandy. You see General Eisenhower visiting the troops on D-Day. We had to take the beaches in Normandy in the face of vicious German attacks and defenses. We had to fight across France. We had to fight in the snow, and we had to fight on tropical beaches. We fought on the land, we fought in the air, we fought on the seas, and we fought back at home. We fought the war, we the people. My father used to tell me about when they called him down to the draft board 2 days after World War II, along with all the other supervisors in the Osprey Mill in Porterdale. And they said, we're going to have to ask y'all to take a deferment to keep the mills going during the war. And my daddy was a funny guy, and he said, well, let me think about it. Okay. But the point was, that was important. That was vital. The Osprey Mill shut down 2 days after Pearl Harbor, and the Seabees came in, and they converted everything in that mill away from sheets and shirt material to war materials. The raft on which Eddie Rickenbacker survived was produced in the Osprey Mill in Porterdale, Georgia. There used to be they opened up 10 days later after the Seabees had converted them, and they ran 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, 365 days a week until VJ Day. There used to be a plaque in the Porterdale Gym with a piece of that raft and a letter from Eddie Rickenbacker thanking the people of Porterdale for doing such outstanding work that life raft would hold up for all those days that he was floating out at sea. And there used to be a plaque with a golden Coca-Cola bottle on it, saying that the Osprey Mill sold more Coca-Colas during World War II than any other single place on Earth. And that's just one example. The whole nation went to work. Rosie the Riveter. Women went to work in the airplane factories, the shipyards. America went to work. We began to outproduce Germany and Japan and every other nation on Earth. Everybody in America took part in the war effort. Children collected scrap metal. Everybody planted victory gardens, because if they could grow enough food, any food that they grew to eat themselves would make more food available for the soldiers. We were involved every day on a daily basis. People went without. There were rationings. You had to have a ration book to buy just about anything. If you wanted a pair of shoes, you had to have a ration ticket. You were allotted one pair a year if you had a ticket. Gasoline was rationed. Sugar was rationed because they used sugar to make explosives. My daddy used to tell me about the little diner he ate in during the war, and they had those little packets of sugar that are the same size as the ones we have now, but it would only have 2 or 3 grains of sugar. And it had instructions painted on the back of it. And it said, open packet, empty contents into cup, stir like hell, imagine. So, you know, We didn't lose our sense of humor during World War II, but we did without. It was illegal to buy a car during World War II because all the factories were making military vehicles. I haven't done without anything since September 11th. You can look at me and tell I haven't rationed any of my food. So America was all involved in the fight. Hollywood, what a difference Hollywood is. Hollywood went to work making movies to support the war effort. We see Charlie Chaplin and the Great Dictator ridiculing Adolf Hitler. Frank Capra, who was the producer who made Mr. Smith Goes to Town, It's a Wonderful Life, all those wonderful movies, went to work for the War Department. He made a series of seven films entitled Why We Fight, which was at first shown to the soldiers when they arrived at basic training and later released to the American people to remind them of why we're in the war. Walt Disney went to work for the War Department. He made all kinds of cartoons ridiculing the Germans and the Japanese and making America the heroes. This is from Donald Duck Goes to War. He also made training films for the military, animated training films. And of course, all of the mainstream Hollywood movies showed the war effort in a positive light. Anybody know who that is? That's Audie Murphy, a Hollywood star who became the most decorated soldier in World War II. Clark Gable, the King of Hollywood, went off to fight in the war. This is General James Stewart, Jimmy Stewart. All right, who can get that one? That's Lee Marvin. Paul Newman, a heavy decorated sailor in World War II. Times have changed. Life has changed in America. A lot of the sports heroes went off to fight in World War II as well. This is Bob Feller, great pitcher for the Cleveland Indians. Anybody know who this fellow is? That's Yogi Berra. Yogi Berra was on a ship during D-Day. Yogi Berra was a war hero. We make a lot of fun of Yogi. This was Ted Williams, the greatest hitter that ever lived. He served two terms. He served 3 years in World War II and 2 years in Korea. There may not be any hitting records left if Ted Williams had not been a fighter pilot in those two wars. And this is Jackie Robinson, who was the commander of the first black tank command allowed in combat during World War II. Has anybody seen the movie 42 yet? I mean, did they bring that up?
Yes.
Oh, good. Because I was going to say that needs to be brought up too. It was a different time. We were a better, stronger country, but we were a united country during World War II. We also enlisted our scientists. Albert Einstein wrote a letter to President Roosevelt saying that before I got out of Germany, I had discovered that a super bomb could be made by splitting the atom, and Hitler is working on that right now. I suggest that you work on it too. Lisa and I went 2 summers ago to the town that was built for the Manhattan Project in New Mexico. We actually saw that letter from Albert Einstein. It was amazing. So Robert Oppenheimer was put in charge of a top secret program, the Manhattan Program, and all he was given was Einstein's work and said, use this to figure out how to build this bomb. They started working in 7 or 8 different locations around the nation, and they found out that they couldn't communicate. It was too hard to communicate. So we decided we would build a town in New Mexico, and we would bring all of the scientists and their families and the military people that were going to be involved and put them in this one town that we pretended didn't exist. So they went out into the middle of New Mexico. There were two things there. of northern New Mexico, there was a Boy Scout camp, which was a year-round school for boys, and an Indian reservation. They relocated the Indian reservations, and they took over the scout facility. And they built a town, Los Alamos. They created a no-fly zone over all of northern New Mexico. And they said, if you try to fly over New Mexico, you will be shot down, period. And they brought all these people here. It was like the first witness protection program. None of their family or friends, nobody knew where they were. They couldn't receive mail addressed to there. They received address to Albuquerque, New Mexico. It was complete secret, and they went to work trying to build this bomb that Albert Einstein had told them could be built. And within 4 years, they had perfected this bomb. So Paul Tibbets and the crew of the Enola Gay left the island of Tinian on August the 6th in 1945 and dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. A lot of discussion about whether we should have done that. A lot of revisionist historians say that the United States was evil, that was a terrible thing, that we made war on citizens, that we entered in the nuclear age, and it was just should not have been done, that it's a black mark on the United States. I'm not one of those people. I realize that we killed a lot of innocent people, but we had firebombed Dresden and killed just as many people. We had bombed Tokyo for a year and a half and killed just as many people. We had been the victims of just as many of the same thing. But I've studied and studied and studied, and the Army, the military had done study after study, and they said that if we invaded Japan, that we would lose 1 million American lives, and up to 4 million Japanese would be killed. So 80,000 people were killed at Hiroshima and 60,000 people were killed at Nagasaki. I'm not real good at math because I went to Georgia, but I think 140,000 is, what's that sign, less than 5 million. I do know this. And a lot of people say the Japanese were just ready to surrender. They were ready to give up, and that Truman only dropped the bomb to scare the Soviet Union because we were probably going to have to get in a war with them. Well, if they were just ready to give up after they dropped that first bomb on Hiroshima, that would have been an excellent time, I think. But they didn't. After we dropped the second bomb on Nagasaki, they did. I went to the Harry Truman Museum, the Independence Museum, Missouri a few years ago, and in the back of the museum is a big monument. Thank you, President Truman, for making the decision to use the atomic bomb and saving our lives. And it was paid for by sailors and Marines and soldiers and airmen of the United States Armed Forces. They put in their own money and built this monument thanking Harry Truman. When Jamie was in the fifth grade, she was doing a social studies project for the social studies fair, and she chose the atomic bomb, and she interviewed a gentleman who's a principal of a school in DeKalb County, and she was asking him if he thought it was right or wrong. He said, "Sweetheart, all I know is on August the 9th, I was on a ship, and when I went to bed that night, the sun was setting right in front of me. When I woke up the next morning, the sun was rising right in front of me." They had turned his ship around in the middle of the night after the second bomb. And of course, in September, Hirohito surrendered to Douglas MacArthur. So America went to war. The men of the armed forces, the women of the selective services, the people at home, we were involved in the war. And we also turned to God. If you read anything about the war, letters from the Marines, we as a nation turn to God. Oh God, our help in ages past, our hope in years to come. You've heard the expression, there are no atheists in a foxhole. We held church services almost nightly in certain parts of America to pray for the troops. The entire nation turned in prayer on many, many occasions. Kate Smith made God Bless America the number one song in America for the duration of the war. We, the people of the United States, turned to God and we turned to prayer. You've all probably heard the great story of General Patton during the Battle of the Bulge. There was a big bulge in the American lines. The Germans were about to break through. If they had been able to break through at Bastogne, then they could have circled around and kept the war going for many, many years, possibly even defeated us. Patton wanted to get up to reinforce Bastogne, but there was terrible weather, rain, snow, and ice. So he instructed his chaplain to write a prayer for good weather. And the chaplain said, well, General, I don't know if the Almighty would appreciate me writing a prayer for good weather so you could go and kill human beings. And he said, I'm in good standing with God Almighty, and I promise you, if you write a good prayer, he'll send us good weather. So you write it. And the chaplain wrote a prayer, and Patton printed it out and gave it to every soldier in his army. And at a given time, they all read the prayer out loud. Almighty and most merciful Father, we humbly beseech thee of thy great goodness to restrain these immoderate rains with which we have had to contend. Grant us fair weather for battle. Graciously hearken us as soldiers who call upon thee, that armed with thy power, we may advance from victory to victory and crush the oppression and wickedness of our enemies and establish thy justice among men and nations. Probably just a coincidence, but 90 minutes later, the skies opened up and the weather that has been predicted to last for 4 days cleared up immediately, and Patton got to Bastogne and saved the day. On D-Day, Franklin Roosevelt went on the radio and prayed this prayer to the whole nation. My fellow Americans, last night when I spoke with you about the fall of Rome, I knew at that moment that troops of the United States and our allies were crossing the channel in another and greater operation. It has come to pass with success thus far. And so in this poignant hour, I ask you to join me in prayer. Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity. Lead them straight and true. Give strength to their arms, stoutness to their hearts, steadfastness in their faith. They will need thy blessings. Their road will be long and hard, for the enemy is strong. He may hurl back our forces. Success may not come with rushing speed, but we shall return again and again. And we know that by thy grace and by thy righteousness of our cause, our sons will triumph. They will be sorely tried by night and day, without rest until the victory is won. The darkness will be rent by noise and flame. Men's souls will be shaken with the violence of war, for these men are lately drawn from the ways of peace. They fight not for the lust of conquest. They fight to end conquest. They fight to liberate. They fight to let justice arise and tolerance and goodwill among all thy people. They yearn but for the end of battle, for their return to the haven of home. Some will never return. Embrace these, Father, and receive them, thy heroic service into thy kingdom. And for us at home, fathers, mothers, children, wives, sisters, and brothers of brave men overseas, whose thoughts and prayers are ever with them, help us, Almighty God, to rededicate ourselves in renewed faith in thee this hour of great sacrifice. With thy blessing, we shall prevail over the unholy forces of our enemy. Help us to conquer the apostles of greed and racial arrogancies, Lead us to the saving of our country and with our sister nations into a world unity that will spell a sure peace, a peace invulnerable to the schemings of unworthy men, and a peace that will let all men live in freedom, reaping the just rewards of their honest toil. Thy will be done, Almighty God. Amen. That was the America of World War II. We were at war, and we constantly ask God's blessings on our endeavors, and we were victorious. We liberated Paris. We liberated Italy. We liberated North Africa. And the only thing we asked was a place to bury our dead. We liberated many of the concentration camps on the Western Front. And we were victorious. And we didn't apologize for being victorious. We celebrated our victory. Victory in Europe and victory in Japan. That was the America of then, and we all owe a tremendous debt to those who survived from that greatest generation. So the next time you're in the line behind somebody at the grocery store with gnarled hands who's having a hard time getting the money to the cashier, you might ask him if he served, and you might thank him. And you might pray that we can once again become a nation that united, because I'm not sure that we ever will. Will you join me in prayer? Eternal God, thank you for the United States of America. We were conceived in liberty, dear God. We were born of blood. We've had so many hundreds of thousands of men and women since that first one gave his life on April 18th in 1775 to win our independence. Dear God, as we've traveled the roads of our history, we've seen good and bad, we've seen right and wrong. But our nation is in trouble, dear Lord, because we no longer have a concept of unity. We no longer have a concept of unity, but we have one of separation and divisiveness. Dear God, we no longer have a feeling of independence, but one of dependence. Please, dear God, touch the heart of every American. As Christians, help us to teach the Americans to seek you. Teach us that you are true to your word, and you have said that if my people who are called by my name shall humble themselves and pray, that you will hear our prayers and that you will bless our nation. Dear God, our prayer today is not that you would bless you us, but that we once again would learn to bless you. In your holy name we pray. Amen. Thank you. Next month, tell everybody you know to come and have a 50s party, because we're gonna rock out. Thank you.